And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, after yesterday's BG retrospective that we did, I've still got jive talking and staying alive in my head as an earworm.
I know what you mean. I know.
Well, this hour we visit with journalist Katie Butler. She writes about neuroscience, medicine, Buddhism, and human behavior. She's written a memoir about complicated end-of-life issues from her family experience. It's called Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. And Katie Butler joins us from San Francisco's KQED. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Joseph. I'm glad to be there.
And thanks for joining us today, Katie.
Thank you, Bonnie.
I'd like if you would start by giving us a picture of your father, Jeffrey, your mom, Valerie, and just a little bit about their lives and their relationship.
They were extremely dynamic, vital people. They were both born in South Africa. My father lost his arm in the Second World War, picked himself up, married my mother, re-educated himself in England, and then the two of them, with me and my two younger brothers, all came to the United States when I was about 8, where they built a beautiful and very, very vital and prosperous American life. And they loved each other absolutely deeply. My mother considered my father her best friend. And they really sailed along and had a pretty wonderful life up until my father hit 79 when he had a devastating stroke.
Okay, let's go from there. Tell us what happened to both him and your mother, how their lives changed dramatically.
It was one of those moments where a family's life is divided forever into before and after. My father lost the capacity for speech pretty much. He couldn't really participate in a conversation after that. In the immediate aftermath of the stroke, my mother had to brush his teeth, fasten his belt, get up 2 or 3 times a night to change the sheets on his bed. So she went from being a vital, active, new old age type person to someone who was a caregiver of someone who had suddenly entered old age. So she pretty much had to give up her yoga and her sewing machine and her knitting and her walks with her friends to become a full-time caregiver. And of course, for my father, was even more devastating because he was a college professor, very, very vital, loved to argue and debate. And suddenly, rather than being essentially the head of the family, the manager of the money, everything, he was suddenly the person who couldn't speak and who needed help with almost all the activities of daily living. And I mean, he was a very tough guy. He was a guy who never gave up easily on anything, as could be seen by the way he recovered from losing his arm. But this was just too much for him, and it was something that no matter how hard he tried, he could not recover from.
You speak about the great love between your mother and your father, but when she suddenly thrust into the position of being a caregiver, was there also some resentment there involved?
Yes. I think in the first year or so, both my mother and I were so overcome with our love for my father and for our desire to try to minimize his suffering that I think we all kind of rose above ourselves and were more patient and more giving than we were as normal human beings. But those moments of crisis pass. And then you go back to being the person you always were with all your limitations. And in my mother's case, she was an impatient person. And I think she was suffering a great deal from what they call ambiguous loss. She had really lost her husband and become his nurse. So she was grieving in a way that she really couldn't put words to. And she was frankly almost angry with him for having had the stroke. And so it was sometimes very painful to go and visit them and see her impatience.
So we get to another defining moment in your father's illness, and he was, so he could get this surgery on a hernia. They suggested placing a pacemaker in your father. What convinced you both that this was the best course of action at that time?
I think older people are sort of like Humpty Dumpty, and they look okay from the outside, and then some blow will push them over the edge and send them into a whole different set of medical problems. And often, these first blows can look very, very tiny, something like inserting a pacemaker. In my father's case, he needed hernia surgery, which they were going to do under general anesthetic. And the cardiologist basically said to my mother, he has a slow heartbeat, therefore he must get a pacemaker or I won't clear him for the hernia surgery. And it seemed like such a minor decision. My father had actually already rejected a pacemaker the year before, and the family doctor was opposed to it for exactly the reason of what happened, which was my father's life was prolonged into a period where he had no reason for living. But at the time the decision was made, it seemed very minor, and my mother basically just shrugged and said yes, not realizing that you really need to start asking questions at that moment. Are there alternatives? Could we do this surgery another way that doesn't involve general anesthesia? Could we use a temporary pacemaker that's external and disconnected after the surgery? She wasn't, you know, she was of her generation, and she was deferent to doctors. It never occurred to her to explore whether this was the only way to go. I, meanwhile, I was out in California, and as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, when people who've been powerful and dominant suddenly hit a health crisis, they don't throw up their hands and say to their children, oh, please take over my life for me. It's a slow, gradual process of building trust and changing the family hierarchy. And we just weren't there yet. I had great doubts out in California. But my reaction was, oh, we really have no choice here. And it's one thing to think, well, I don't want to overly extend my father's life because he's so damaged and unhappy. And it's quite another thing to say, well, go ahead, take the risk. Give him a surgery that he might not survive. I at that point didn't understand that we had other choices, and I certainly didn't want to do anything like that.
So essentially, the pacemaker prolonged your father's life when he really didn't want to live anymore.
That is sadly the case. A year after the pacemaker went in, he said to my mother, I'm living too long. And he was a stoic. I mean, he wasn't the kind of person who made that kind of comment easily.
You said it wasn't life your father was living, but a prolonged and attenuated dying. But at the time, you thought you were doing the best for him.
This is what is so fascinating and so important, I think, and one of the things that writing the book really helped me understand. All of our lives, we think of the loving thing as advocating for more for our family or from the healthcare system, you know. And then in the last 5 years of life, the decision-making starts to shift. And often the loving thing is to recommend doing less rather than more. And this is not strictly just in terms of extending life or not extending life, or really looking at these important questions of quality of life and comfort care. It's also just the plain danger of hospitals, that hospitals are dangerous places where people pick up infections. And as you get older, the risks of entering a hospital really go up and the benefits go down. And so the whole algebra of making the loving and responsible medical decision really, really shift.
I wonder what would have happened if your father had been alone, say if he were a widower and didn't have children. What would have happened then?
The irony is that the less family members you have involved, the more likely you are to have over-treatment approaching the end of life. For example, people in nursing homes who have dementia, those with families are less likely to be given feeding tubes, which are very, very uncomfortable and don't do much even to prolong life. And those with no family are more likely to get these devices because, frankly, they're very convenient for the managers of nursing homes because it's easier to feed someone through a tube than to hand feed them. Yeah, sorry, these are tough examples. But all of these are questions that have been kind of under the rug in our culture. And now that so many people are living over the age of 85 and so many baby boomers are also involved in caring for very elderly parents, I really feel it's time this conversation became so much more public than it's been. Because across the country, right now, as we're talking, lots and lots of families are struggling with some version of these questions. Do we say yes or no to dialysis? Do we say yes or no to taking someone out of an ICU or saying, please don't put me in the ICU? Do not resuscitate orders. All of these are decisions that our ancestors never had to make. But since the 1960s, we've gotten so good at life-saving that we're having to cope with the shadow side of these amazing medical advances.
I'd like to go talk more about that because you say it was very different in the 50s and 60s, but we need to take a short break, so please stay with us. We're visiting with journalist Katie Butler, and her latest book is entitled, it's a memoir, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. We'll be right back. And thank you for joining us for Topical Currents today. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. And we're speaking with award-winning journalist Katie Butler about her memoir, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. When we left off, Katie, you mentioned about the 60s or the 50s. You spoke of the terror and ignorance of death today, unlike in the 50s and 60s. You said we were more courageous about facing death. Would you explain that?
Going back to the 1400s, the West had a finely developed religious tradition of facing one's death and contemplating it ahead of time. In the 1400s, there was a best-selling book called The Art of Dying, and it was a how-to manual to how to behave at your own deathbed, what to say, what prayers to say, how your relatives should comfort you. And versions of these books existed all the way through the 1800s. Death then was random, unpredictable. Babies died before the age of two. Mothers died in childbirth. Infectious diseases were rampant. So people had to, by necessity, understand how to be at a deathbed and how to die. And then we got so good at our medicine in the 50s and 60s and really pretty much abolished natural death and sudden death. We can put these off often almost indefinitely without restoring true meaningful life. And this happened to coincide in our culture with the time when many, many people stopped going to church or to temple and stopped practicing the old traditions. And so people lost the language of rites of passage that could help steer people through this tremendously painful but meaningful transition.
Touch on how the road to death can also affect sibling relations. How did it affect your family?
Well, this is the in-towners third rail versus the of the emotional. Yes. There's the... I had two younger brothers. Both of them were much, much less involved in my care of my parents than I was. Partly that was because I was a freelance writer and I was in a sort of better financial situation to fly back and forth across the country. But maybe it's also a male-female difference or being the oldest child rather than younger children. You shoulder certain kinds of responsibility in a family. But as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, this can create tremendous resentment after a parent's death when one child feels that they have carried a huge burden and the others have not. And there are even caregiving manuals that really suggest that the caregiving child be paid either more of the estate or a reasonable but low hourly wage for the hours that they put in that the siblings don't. I also just recommend having a serious come to Jesus meeting with your siblings, either over the phone or whatever, and just, there were times I had to say to my brothers, look, I've been there 3 times this year. It's your turn. Someone else needs to jump on the plane now. And frankly, I wish I had done a little bit more of that than I did. And they would have been happier too.
I'd like to get back to your father. He continued to decline. He pretty much lost his sight, and then, I mean, things just got worse and worse, and you began having thoughts about removing or deactivating, rather, your father's pacemaker. Tell us about that whole process for you and what you went through, and then when your mother's decision to do that, just about that.
I was writing some health articles for the New York Times at the time, and I was just exploring around looking for other health stories. And I ran across someone called a bioethicist. This is a person that's on the staff of almost every hospital to try to adjudicate difficult moral decisions. And she told me, A, that the pacemaker could be painlessly deactivated, which I didn't know, none of us knew, and B, that she thought doctors had a moral responsibility to tell patients when these devices went in that there might be a time that the family wanted, or the patient themselves, wanted the device turned off, and that it could be turned off, and that the patient had the right to have it turned off. This was a total revelation to me. None of these issues had ever been raised or discussed when we first contemplated the pacemaker. And so I began to lobby my mother to consider turning the pacemaker off, because I felt my father's life had become not a blessing to him anymore, but a curse, and that a natural death would have already occurred if he had not had the pacemaker. This was very difficult. I don't want to say anything that would make anyone out there think that these decisions are easy, because I feel we're all kind of wandering through the fog trying to make these decisions out of love and out of our deepest, deepest values. And they're not easy, and we don't really even have a language in our culture right now to even discuss them. So that's sort of where we found ourselves. And, you know, I was a reporter, so I also did research on the internet and discovered that many doctors had participated in turning off pacemakers or defibrillators, which is another internalized cardiac device, and that there was a wide, wide range of feeling and opinion among cardiologists about whether this was right or wrong.
But as the closest family members, you and your mother, shouldn't you have been able to make that decision without anyone else taking a dim view of it?
Well, this is the terrible, tragic consequence of our success with medicine, which is these high-tech devices are very easy to say yes to, but they're very hard to say no to. Because it's one thing to say, would you please turn off this device? But this is a highly technical instrument. I have no idea how you would deactivate such a device. I mean, I do now because I wrote the book. But it's easy to say yes. It's kind of like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Do you remember that Disney movie where he casts a spell and a whole bunch of brooms start moving mm-hmm. around and buckets of water? It's like once you get things started, it can be very, very hard to say it's time to stop. And the power ends up in the hands of doctors who barely know you or your family or your family's values, because they're the experts.
So when your mom reversed course and decided, yes, she wanted to have it deactivated, what did the doctor do?
The doctor said no. She asked him to refer her to a doctor who would say yes. He told her that he had checked around at the Catholic hospital where he was on staff and nobody else was willing. And then she really came back to me and said, Katie, I want you to help me get this device turned off. It was a horrible moment. My own heart just beat in my chest when she said it. And I knew I had to help them, and I said yes. But it wasn't easy.
I was in a situation with my mother in a nursing home, and it was just a terrible situation for her. And my sister and I, we were kind of kidding, but sometimes we would say, you know, let's just put a pillow over her.
I'm so glad you said that. That phrase has been, you know, uttered by many, many an adult child in the middle of watching this degree of suffering and feeling both helpless and bewildered. I could never have done such a thing.
Nor could I.
Not only, yes, exactly. I mean, and not only because I loved him, but because I was also afraid. Even though, you know, I've known of other people whose parents have literally begged them to do pretty much exactly that. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a woman right now in Pennsylvania who is being charged with her manslaughter or murder in her own father's death because she gave him morphine that he was begging for. So we have no consensus in this culture on where to draw the line. Personally, I was willing to move heaven and earth to remove all barriers to a natural death, but I could have not taken a single step that was across that line in terms of hastening his death, which is an arbitrary line because, you know, as many friends of mine have said, we don't put our pets through this. You know, right. We love our dogs, and when we see that they're suffering too much, we take them in and we give them a drug. And I personally could not participate in something like that, even though I watched my father die on a hospice unit with pneumonia over the course of 5 or 6 days, and it was excruciating to be there and hold his hand and know that he was suffering and know what the end was, and also know that I couldn't have lived with myself if we had done anything to hasten it, even though we actually made him suffer more pain. These are quandaries, and I think part of the point of Knocking on Heaven's Door is just to say, let's make this conversation public. Let's get out of this death panel caricature and really, really speak about the realities that we are living with and where we are trying to find our way so that we can get back to the good deaths that our ancestors idealized and really prepared for. Because my mother's death was actually a very good death because she saw what happened to my father. And she died a very, very different way. And if you do say no to technology, it's in some ways a just say no situation. And if you're informed and you do just say no, you can return to the old ways when things were quite a bit simpler and less expensive and less technological and more spiritual and more connected emotionally.
You mentioned your mother. How difficult was it for you when she refused any extraordinary measures or interventions at that time?
You know, it was very difficult. You know, there I was in my father's case saying, lobbying for let's stop all this unnecessary medicine. And in my mother's case, I was the opposite. She refused open heart surgery because of the risks of stroke and dementia. And afterwards, a nurse of hers lobbied me and said, please try and get your mother to change her mind because she's so healthy otherwise. So I called her and said, are you sure? The doctor said if you have this surgery, you could live to be 90. She was 84. And she said, I don't want to live to be 90. Your father was my best friend. And I had to reverse course and support her. And so when, a little bit later, she had a heart attack, and again, a new set of cardiologists said, we want to give her open heart surgery. It was going to be $80,000 to $150,000 worth of open heart surgery covered by Medicare. I came back at them and said, look, she declined all this when she was healthier and had a better chance of surviving it, and now you want to do it now? So I had to advocate like a tiger for her to make sure she didn't get what she didn't want. But it was very, very hard for me, and I remember calling her on the phone and crying and saying, I'm going to miss you. You're not only my mother, you're my really close friend. So it was, none of this is easy. It doesn't matter whether it's someone dies too soon or they die too late. We're never ready, really, to have people we love die and say goodbye. And so I wasn't as resolved with my mother as I was with my father at the time of her death. I had less time to prepare, and we had a very different relationship anyway. But I had to do what she so clearly wanted. If I could have, there was a time I sort of gave it a shot. I made sure that she really was expressing what she really, really wished for. And she was. And she was a very strong, you know, she was a very headstrong, bullheaded woman. And she did what she wanted to do. And she definitely died the way she wanted to die.
We're speaking with Katie Butler. She's a journalist, writes about neuroscience, medicine, Buddhism, human behavior, and more. And her memoir is entitled Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be right back.
Take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
Katie, you said you listened a lot to that when you were writing.
Yes, yes, I think it's such a beautiful song. And it has such a feeling of the approach of death and knowing that the approach of death is coming and being willing in some way to open up to that experience, which is unfortunately the skill that we have so much lost in our culture and need to get back to.
So death is hardest on the living. I'm sorry. Death is hardest on the living.
Yes, go ahead. It's funny. Dying's hard on the dying, and death is hardest on the living. And I think sometimes we don't let the people we love die, or we won't listen to them when they start to say, I don't want to ever go back into a hospital again. Or, I mean, people sometimes just literally wake up and saying, why am I still alive? And I think we've got to be very careful to distinguish between being loving and being kind to our relatives when they are approaching this final mystery, this final passage, and make sure we're not keeping them on earth because of our own emotional needs rather than what they need. Mm-hmm. There's an expression in hospitals called the nephew from Peoria. This is the estranged family member who's been very little involved in someone's care. And at the last minute, they fly in, and they're the relative that says to the doctors, you've got to do everything. And sometimes doctors will do so because they're afraid of being sued, even if the person has signed a do not resuscitate order and has, chosen a different family member to be the decision maker. We really need to face these things before the final crisis. There's a wonderful phrase in the hospice movement which goes, thank you, I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, and goodbye. And these are the emotional tasks of the last chapter of life. And the more we can consciously have these conversations with people we love, I think the easier it can be to then talk to them about something like, do you want a do not resuscitate order? I think people try to plunge into these technical discussions of, do you want to be in an ICU or not? Or do you want to be on a respirator? When there's really a much, much deeper conversation that needs to take place first, and that's about exchanging love and thanks and forgiveness.
I'd like to turn to the medical side of this. You say you don't blame the doctors. You feel a lot of compassion for them because they've been put in this impossible situation, and a lot of it has to do with the culture. But you write that Medicare rewards doctors far better for doing procedures than for assessing whether they should be done at all. How important is the economic factor in keeping the elderly alive?
I think it's tremendously important because families have been complaining about deaths in the intensive care unit for more than 20 years. And things are not getting better. In fact, they're getting worse. More people are spending time in an ICU in their last year of life. 30% of people spend time in an ICU in their last year of life. I put a lot of this down to the reimbursement structure. Doctors who really know the patients, like family medicine doctors, really know the family, they earn about $150,000 or so a year, whereas the specialists who come in at the last minute and are devoted to just trying to save a single organ, like the kidney or the heart, those people very rarely know the family, and they make over $450,000 a year, sometimes considerably more. So we are essentially saying to doctors as they enter medical school, we value and will reward high-tech fixes, whether or not they're appropriate for the patient, and we will denigrate and hardly pay the family doctor, the hospice doctor, the palliative care doctor, all the people who take care and minister to the needs, the full needs of the patient as a full human being, not just a technical fix for, let's say, a single organ. So you get these terrible situations at the end of life where you have a number of very, very highly paid specialists, and each is working on just one organ. It's kind of like a car repair shop where you have, like, you know, no chief and five different people working on different sections of the engine, and none of them taking a step back and saying, what are we really doing here? So you have one person trying to fix the heart, somebody else trying to fix the kidneys. They're all mm-hmm. failing, and nobody is taking a step back and saying, there's suffering involved for this poor patient. And is this suffering going to have a payoff? Because if you do die in intensive care, patients actually feel like they are literally being tortured. And doctors who treat intensive care, who work in intensive care, literally have used the phrase medically sanctioned torture to explain what they're doing. In such a situation, if someone's not going to survive, is it really moral? Is it really an expression of the Hippocratic Oath to be prolonging the suffering of the final moments? And these deaths can be extremely expensive. You can spend $323,000 in 10 days in intensive care. And they say $187 billion a year in medical care in America is waste. It's over-treatment. It's unnecessary treatment. But that represents a lot of profit for drug makers, for makers of medical devices. They're very, very profitable business to be in. And naturally, these sectors want to maximize their markets. They are businesses, and that's what they're supposed to do. And I don't blame them. But we don't have any kind of overview or limiting of overuse intelligently so that we reduce the amount of suffering that people are being brought through when they're put through unnecessary treatment at the end of life.
We had a university chief cardiologist on the program. I can't think of his name right now, but he's written several books.
I don't remember. And
he was saying that, like, two out of five heart surgeries really aren't necessary. But wow. it's such an income generating area for the hospitals.
It's a huge, if you see the large full page ads in some newspapers saying, come to us for our cardiology care, come to us for our cancer care. When you see those ads, you know what the profit center in that particular hospital are. That's why they're advertising, and they use the money to help balance off services that don't pay as well as they should.
I was referring to Dr. Michael Osner. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Katie.
Okay. Great. Yes, and one thing I discovered in the course of writing Knocking on Heaven's Door is that if you are an oncologist and you give a chemotherapy, you get 6% of the price tag of the chemo on top of your physician's fee. So essentially, we have incentivized using the most expensive chemo and using the chemo even after a point when using chemo is futile. That same doctor, if he wants to do the right thing and sit down and have a very painful and direct, honest, deep conversation with you and your family. Now, that is a conversation and a relationship that could take an hour or two if it were really beautifully done. He will be paid almost nothing, like maybe $50 for an office visit. So we've created absurd incentives towards expensive, highly medicalized hospital deaths that leave the survivors traumatized.
Do you see any solutions and how they can be enacted?
Yes, both on the personal level and on the political level.
Okay.
On the personal level, my mother is a sterling example. You can do your research, you can face your own death, you can prepare for it, and you can't say no. You have the legal and moral right to refuse any medical treatment that you don't want. And this could mean some very tough conversations with family members who aren't ready, like your kids, like me. On the larger economic level, how we fund and reimburse Medicare, I would like to see a tripling of the hospice benefit, so it's a really substantial daily benefit, and they can provide substantial home nursing services during hospice. I think hospice should be a one-year benefit instead of a six-month benefit. And we need a whole public relations campaign to explain to people that hospice and palliative care are not for the last 3 days of life, for the 3 days of active dying. Dying is a spectrum event. It can take 6 months. It can take a year. It can take more. And if we really funded our palliative care and our hospice services sufficiently, people could have really much, much better quality of life and really healing passages from this life with a lot of support in their last year of life. And naturally, some of this money would have to be taken away from pacemakers like my dad's that was put in, $12,500, totally unnecessary. A death of a friend of mine whose father died in intensive care took 10 days, $323,000, totally unnecessary. If we took some of that kind of money that not only costs a lot but also creates emotional havoc for survivors and for the person who's suffering it, we could have deluxe, the best hospice palliative care in the world for the money that we waste and really deploy very poorly at the end of life.
We're speaking with journalist Katie Butler, her memoir, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. One more short break and we'll return.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we continue our conversation with journalist Katie Butler, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, A Path to a Better Way of Death. And let me remind our listeners that we'll have links to both Katie Butler and her book at the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as our website, that's WLRN.org. And we'll take a call or two. This is Ray in Miami Lakes. Hi there.
Hi. I have a comment regarding the relationship that occurs between physicians that are in palliative medicine and those that are oncologists. And the there's a constant battle between these two realms and being able to have the patient be able to decide what their best course is for end of life, and knowing that it's going to be a comfortable end of life. I think a lot of patients out there, family members, don't know that this type of physician is out there that is willing to bring forth these options, and also the physician that's willing to stand up to the oncologist. And be able to work as a team, hopefully as a team, and not necessarily as adversaries.
Okay.
I think that's a tremendous point. And in New York State, a law was passed in New York State, pushed by a group called Compassion and Choices, which is a great organization. It requires oncologists, anyone dealing with a terminally ill patient, to present the truth to the patient and let them know that hospice and palliative care are available. Unfortunately, this was fought by the state division of the AMA because of feeling like it's intruding on the doctor-patient relationship. But in fact, I think patients have a right to information, especially to these wonderful services like palliative care and hospice, that can absolutely transform the last months of life and take such a burden off families.
What's been the reaction from doctors to your book?
Totally depends on the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
The palliative care doctors, the hospice doctors, the family medicine doctors love the book. Depending on the nature of the cardiologist, some of them love it and some of them don't. I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal this last weekend that was taken from the book, and I got a beautiful, it was about my mother's death and how beautifully she faced her death, and I got a beautiful, there was a beautiful comment on the journal's website from a cardiologist saying, Katie Butler's absolutely right, we do have all this over-treatment, and really being completely supportive. So there's a huge range out there. There are some forms of cardiology, such as the pacemaker experts, they're called electrophysiologists. And so it's a very, very technical, almost like an engineering branch of cardiology. And I think it's just harder for them. Maybe the people who are drawn to that as an interest in the first place are not necessarily the people who are the most adept with emotional relationships or looking at a big picture. And I think for them, some of them, what I'm talking about is I'm just like talking Greek. They just don't understand.
You know, you had some pretty surprising statistics about pacemakers who establishes the guidelines with a gross conflict of interest there. Could you tell us about this, what your findings were?
Yes, I'm sorry. I don't have the book in front of me, and I don't remember the statistics exactly.
Well, just but generally.
Yes, just in general, treatment guidelines are created that are supposed to determine who should get a pacemaker, who doesn't, depending on their diagnoses. And these diagnoses continue to expand. And so people with more and more minor problems get diagnosed as needing pacemakers. Out of the group that wrote these guidelines, the majority had some major research funding or other form of funding from one of the three biggest pacemaker companies. So they got speaking fees, or they had research funded one way or another, or they were invested, heavily invested, in one of these companies, or they had a startup of their own. And when I talked to one of the experts who helped create the guidelines, he said, well, look, all the experts have these ties. So if we eliminated everyone who had these ties, we wouldn't have any experts left to write the guidelines. And I think that's a terrible, terrible comment.
Yes, it really is. And you say that it holds true across almost all cardiac treatments.
Yes.
Katie, I was really struck by your mother's decision. Your father said he'd wanted to be buried traditionally in like the family plot, and your mother decided, no, we're going to cremate him. What was behind that?
Well, that was just my mother's nature. She was kind of no muss, no fuss. He won't know anyway. And as they say, there's a Thomas Lynch is a brilliant essayist, and he says the dead don't care, that the funeral rites are for the living. And I really felt I would have loved to have buried him where he wanted to be buried. But I really felt if anyone had earned the right to speak, it was my mother. She had gone through 6.5 years of absolutely spirit-breaking caregiving. She loved him better than anyone in the world. And at the point right after his death, I was not going to be that nephew from Peoria who flies in and insists on doing things their way. I mean, I really did feel it was her decision to make.
I had a will made, and I decided that I specified in the will that I wanted my ashes to be scattered over Biscayne Bay. I reworked the will and said, why should I have to have people go out there and mess around with that? Once I'm gone, I'm gone. They don't have to take that time and go out on a boat or on a bridge or something like that.
Oh, don't deprive them.
Yeah, they may want
really,
to.
Really, don't
well,
deprive
if,
them.
If they want to, if they insist on it, fine, but I'm not going to insist on it in the will.
Katie, are there any other... I'm sorry, go on.
Well, you know, today is 9/11, and I think that's such an interesting day in two ways. One, that few of us die suddenly like that anymore. The second is that at least we memorialize this, and I think we've stripped too much ritual out of the dying and death process. And I'd say three chairs if they have to go out in Biscayne Bay and take an afternoon and really get a chance to bring some beauty into the experience of your death.
I was going to ask you, I heard you speak about the Family Caregiver Alliance. Who are they?
Wonderful organization based in San Francisco with a wonderful website. It's the Family Caregiver Alliance. They are also active in trying to produce better support for caregivers on a national level. They understand that this is both a political issue in terms of where do we put our support, and it's also an overwhelming personal issue for each family as they become involved in long-term caregiving.
I guess I just have one other question about your Buddhism. You're a Buddhist. You say you have a strong Christian or Anglican, Christian-Anglican background. How do your beliefs shape your ideas about death?
I came to Buddhism when I was in my early 30s. And in the Buddhist tradition, Buddha discovered meditation and his path for a freedom from suffering, because as a young prince, he went outside the palace walls and was horrified to see examples of old age, sickness, and death. And he felt these are the three things that we struggle with as human beings. Old age, sickness, and death, they horrify us. And they symbolize the fact that everything in life changes, and the more we resist those changes, the more painful we make them. So Buddhism is in some ways a religion with a technology of acceptance behind it. And the more we can accept the fact that death is actually a part of our lives, and the more we open to that experience and handle it with some peace and with some love, the better it's going to be for everybody, not just the dying, but also those who survive the dying.
Well, Katie Butler, award-winning journalist, her memoir, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. We want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Joseph and Bonnie. I really, really enjoyed being with you and having a chance to talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anther, thanks for making us a part of your day. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow's program begins with an examination of what it means to simply say, I don't know. Sometimes it's the best answer to a question. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining. And the calendar, of course, the 12th anniversary of terrorist 9/11 infamy. 2,752 died as a direct result of the attacks, and the effects still continue. And on this day in 1885, 118 years ago, the birth of English writer D.H. Lawrence in Eastwood, Lady Chatterley's Lover, Women in Love, Sons and Lovers. And on this day in 1928, 85 years ago, the birth of Florida Governor Reuben O'Donovan Askew in Muskogee, Oklahoma. He turned down a running mate offer from George McGovern in 1972. Probably a good decision. And one more before we say Dos Vidania. On this day, 1971, 42 years ago, the death of former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev of a heart attack. He succeeded Stalin, of course, was ousted in 1964. Check out the Topical Currents Facebook page and WLRN.org. And we close with a thought from D.H. Lawrence, who died in France in 1930 at age 44. Quote, I want to live my life so that my nights are not full of regrets. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay with us next hour for the Here and Now from NPR News.